Chapter 1. The star vanished from the center of the telescope's image in less time than a single human heartbeat. There was no mistake. Dudley Bowes was looking right at it when it happened. He blinked in surprise, drawing back from the eyepiece. "That's not right," he muttered. He shivered slightly in reaction to the cold air around him, slapping gloved hands against his arms. His wife, Wendy, had insisted he wrap up well against the night, and he dutifully left the house in a thick woolen coat and sturdy hiking trousers. As always, when the sun fell below Graalmund's horizon, any warmth in the planet's thinner-than-average atmosphere dissipated almost immediately. With the telescope housing open to the elements at 2 o'clock in the morning, the temperature had dropped enough to turn his every breath into a stream of grey mist. Dudley shook the fatigue from his head and leaned back into the eyepiece. The starfield pattern was the same. There had been no slippage in the telescope's alignment, but Dyson Alpha was still missing. "It couldn't be that fast," he said. He'd been observing the Dyson pair for 14 months now, searching for the first clues of the envelopment that would so dramatically alter the emission spectrum. Until tonight there had been no change to the tiny yellow speck of light, 1,240 light-years away from Graalmund, that was Dyson Alpha. He'd known there would be a change. It was the astronomy department at Oxford University back on Earth that had first noticed the anomaly during a routine sky scan back in 2170, 210 years ago. Since the previous scan 20 years earlier, two stars, a K-type and an M-type, 3 years apart, had changed their emission spectrum completely to non-visible infrared. For a few brief months, the discovery had caused some excited debate among the remnants of the astronomy fraternity about how they could decay into red giants so quickly, and the extraordinary coincidence of two stellar neighbors doing so simultaneously. Then a newly settled planet, 50 light-years farther out from Earth, reported that the pair were still visible in their original spectrum. Working back across the distance, checking the spectrum at various distances from Earth, allowed astronomers to work out that the change to both stars had occurred over a period of approximately 7 or 8 years. Given that amount of time, the nature of the change ceased to become a question of astronomy. Stars of that category took a great deal longer to transform into red giants. Their emission hadn't changed due to any natural stellar process. It was the direct result of technological intervention on the grandest possible scale. Somebody had built a solid shell around each star. It was a feat whose scale was rivaled only by its time frame. 8 years was astonishingly swift to fabricate such a gigantic structure, and this advanced civilization had apparently built two at the same time. Even so, the concept wasn't entirely new to the human race. In the 21st century, a physicist named Freeman Dyson had postulated that the artifacts of a technologically advanced civilization would ultimately surround their star in order to utilize all of its energy. Now someone had turned his ancient hypothesis into reality. It was inevitable that the two stars would be formally christened the Dyson pair. Speculative papers were written after the Oxford announcement, and theoretical studies performed into how to dismantle Jovian-sized planets to produce such a shell. But there was no real urgency connected to the discovery. The human race had already encountered several sentient alien species, all of them reassuringly harmless, and the intersolar commonwealth was expanding steadily. It would be a matter of only a few centuries until a wormhole was opened to the Dyson pair. Any lingering questions about their construction could be answered then by the aliens themselves. Now he'd seen that the envelopment was instantaneous. Dudley was left with a whole new set of very uncomfortable questions about the composition of the shell structure. An 8-year construction period for any solid shell that size had been assessed as remarkable, but obviously achievable. When he'd begun the observation, he'd expected to note a year-by-year eclipse of the star's light, as more and more segments were produced and locked into place. This changed everything. To appear so abruptly, the shell couldn't be solid. It had to be some kind of force field. Why would anyone surround a star with a force field? "Are we recording?" he asked his e-butler.
"We are not," the e-butler replied. "No electronic sensors are currently active at the telescope focus."
The voice was slightly thin, treble-boosted, a tone that had been getting worse over the last few years. Dudley suspected the Ock tattoo on his ear was starting to degenerate. Organic circuitry was always susceptible to antibody attack, and his was over 25 years old. Not that the glittery scarlet and turquoise spiral on his skin had changed. A classic spree of youthful dynamism after his last rejuvenation had made him choose a visible pattern, stylish and chic in those days. Now it was rather embarrassing for a middle-aged professor to sport around the campus. He should have had the old pattern erased and replaced with something more discreet. But somehow he'd never gotten around to it, despite his wife's repeated requests. "Damn it!" Dudley grunted bitterly. But the idea of his e-butler taking the initiative had been a pretty forlorn hope. Dyson Alpha had risen only 40 minutes earlier. Dudley had been setting up the observation, performing his standard final verification, an essential task, thanks to the poorly maintained mechanical systems that orientated the telescope. He never ordered the sensor activation until the checks were complete. That prissy routine might have just cost him the entire observation project. Dudley went back for another look. The little star was still stubbornly absent in the visual spectrum. "Bring the sensors online now, will you please? I need to have some sort of record of tonight."
"Recording now," Izzy Butler said. "The sensors could benefit from recalibrating. The entire image is considerably short of optimum."
"Yeah, I'll get onto it," Dudley replied absently.
The state of the sensors was a hardware problem, one that he ought to assign to his students, all three of them, along with 100 other tasks, he thought wearily. He pushed back from the telescope and used his feet to propel the black leather office chair across the bare concrete floor of the observatory. The rattling noise from its old casters echoed thinly around the cavernous interior. There was enough vacant space for a host of sophisticated ancillary systems, which could bring the observatory up to near professional standards. It could even house a larger telescope. But the Grauman University lacked the funds for such an upgrade, and had so far failed to secure any commercial sponsorship from CST, Compression Space Transport, the only company truly interested in such matters. The astronomy department survived on a collection of meager government grants and a few endowments from pure science foundations. Even an Earth-based educational charity made an annual donation. Beside the door was the long wooden bench that served as a de facto office for the whole department. It was covered with banks of aging, second-hand electronic equipment and high-res display portals. Dudley's briefcase was also there, containing his late-night snacks and a flask of tea. He opened the case and started munching on a chocolate cookie as the sensor images swam up into the display portals. "Put the infrared on the primary display," he told the e-butler. Holographic speckles in the large main portal shoaled into a false color image of the starfield, centered around the Dyson pair. Dyson Alpha was now emitting a faint infrared signature. Slightly to one side and 2 light-years farther away, Dyson Beta continued to shine normally in its M-type spectrum.
"So that really was the envelopment event," Dudley mused.
It would be 2 years before anyone could prove whether the same thing had happened simultaneously at Dyson Beta. At least people would have to acknowledge that the Dyson Alpha event occurred in under 23 hours, the time since his last recorded observation. It was a start, but a bad one. After all, he'd just witnessed something utterly astounding. But without a recording to back him up, his report was likely to generate only disbelief, and a mountainous struggle to maintain his already none-too-high reputation. Dudley was 92, in his second life, and fast approaching time for another rejuvenation. Despite his body having the physical age of a standard 50-year-old, the prospect of a long, degrading campaign within academia was one he regarded with dread. For a supposedly advanced civilization, the Intersolar Commonwealth could be appallingly backward at times, not to mention cruel.
"Maybe it won't be that bad," he told himself.
The lie was comforting enough to get him through the rest of the night's shift. The Carlton All-Lander drove Dudley home just after dawn. Like the astronomer, the vehicle was old and worn, but perfectly capable of doing its job. It had a cheap diesel engine, common enough on a semi-frontier world like Grauman,
although its drive array was a thoroughly modern photoneural processor. With its high suspension and deep tread tires, it could plough along the dirt track to the observatory in all weather and seasons, including the meter-deep snow of Graumond's winters. This morning, all it had to surmount was a light drizzle and a thin slick of mud on the track. The observatory was situated on the high moorland, 90 kilometers to the east of Leonida City, the planet's capital. Not exactly a mountain-top perch, but it was the highest land within any reasonable distance, and unlikely ever to suffer from light pollution. It was 40 minutes before the Carlton started to descend into the lower valleys, where the main highway meandered along the base of the slopes. Only then were there any signs of human activity. A few farmsteads had been built in the sheltered folds of the land, where dense stretches of dark native evergreen cinnamel trees occupied the ground above every stream and river. Grazing meadows had been established on the bleak hillsides, where animals shivered in the cold winds blowing down off the moorland. All the while, as the Carlton bobbed cautiously along the track, Dudley pondered how he could realistically break the news. Even a 23-hour envelopment was a concept that the Commonwealth's small fraternity of professional astronomers would dismiss out of hand. To claim it had happened in a split second would open him to complete ridicule, and invariably to an in-house status review from the university. As to the physicists and engineers who heard his claim, they'd gleefully contribute to the case against him. Had he been at the start of his career, he might have done it, achieving a degree of notoriety before finally proving himself right. The little man overcoming formidable odds, a semi-heroic, or at least romantically poetic, figure. But now, taking such risks was too great. He needed another 8 years of uninterrupted employment, even on the university's demeaningly low salary, before his R&R pension was full. Without that money, there was no way he could pay for a rejuvenation. And who in the last decades of the 24th century was going to employ a discredited astronomer? He stared out at the landscape beyond the vehicle's windows, unconsciously stroking the Ock tattoo on his ear. A wan light was illuminating the low undulating landscape of drab, damp cordgrass, revealing miserable-looking terrestrial cows and herds of the local bovine nigene. There must have been a horizon out there, but the bleak grey sky made it hard to tell where it began. As vistas went, this had to be one of the most depressing of all the inhabited worlds. Dudley closed his eyes and sighed. "And yet it moves," he whispered. As rebellions went, Dudley's was fairly pitiful. He knew he couldn't ignore what he'd seen out there among the eternal unchanging constellations. Somewhat thankfully, he realized, he still had enough dignity left to make sure he didn't take the easy burial option, yet announcing the envelopment to the public would be the end of his own particular world. What others regarded as his essential meekness, he liked to think of as a caution that went with age, similar to wisdom, really. Old habits die hard, so he broke the problem down into stages, the way he always taught his students, and set about solving each one with as much logic as he could apply. Very simply, his overwhelming priority was to confirm the speed of the envelopment. A wavefront of proof that was currently receding from Graumont at the speed of light, and Graumont was almost the farthest extent of the Commonwealth in this section of space. Almost, but not quite. The intersolar Commonwealth occupied a roughly spherical volume of space with Earth at the center, measuring 400 light-years across. Graumont was 240 light-years from Earth, among the last of the second expansion phase planets to be settled. It didn't require a great deal of calculation for Dudley to find that the next planet to witness the envelopment would be Tanyata, right on the edge of Phase 2 space. Tanyata was even less developed than Graumont. There was certainly no university yet, but a Unisphere data search did find him a list of local amateur astronomers. There was one name on it. 5 months and 3 days after the evening he'd seen Dyson Alpha vanish, Dudley nervously waved goodbye to his wife as the Carlton pulled out of their driveway. She thought his trip to Tanyata was legitimate, sanctioned by the university. Even after 11 years of marriage, he didn't have the courage to tell her the absolute truth. Or maybe it was that after 5 marriages he knew what to keep quiet about. The Carlton drove him directly to the CST planetary station on the other side of Leonidas City from the university campus. Spring was just arriving, bringing a sprinkling of vivid green buds to the terrestrial saplings in the city's parks. Even the full-grown native trees were responding to the longer, brighter days. Their dark purple bark had acquired a new lustrous sheen as they prepared to unfurl their leaf awnings. Dudley watched the city's residents from his seat. Business people striding about with purpose, parents being tolerant or exasperated with their kids, first-life adolescents milling about together outside coffee houses and mall entrances, hopelessly gauche, yet still managing to look like the most lethal gang members in human history, all of them so bright and normal. Dudley had chosen to settle here late in his second life because frontier planets always had an infectious air of expectation and hope. This was where new dreams really could take root and grow. And he'd done so little with that second life. His slightly desperate relocation here was an acknowledgement of that. CST had opened their planetary station on Graalmond over 25 years ago, about the time Dudley was getting his colourful Ock tattoo, in fact, an irony that hadn't escaped him. The planet had done well for itself during its first quarter century of human history. Farmers had set their tractor bots and herds loose on the land. Urbanites brought prefab buildings that they lined up in neat grids and called cities, in homage to the great metropolises they hoped would one day evolve from such humble beginnings. Factories were imported, riding in on the strong tide of investment money. Hospitals, schools, theatres and government offices multiplied fruitfully around them. Roads expanded out from the population centre, sending exploratory tendrils across the continent. And as always, the trains came after them, bearing the greater load of commerce. Dudley's Carlton drove along the side of the Mersey Rail Route as he neared CST's planetary station. A simple chain-link fence and a plastic safety barrier was all that separated the dual-lane highway from the thick lines of carbon-bonded steel rails. The Mersey Rail Route was one of five major track lanes that had so far been laid out of the station. Graalmond's population was rightly proud of them. 5 in 25 years, a good sign of a healthy, expanding economy. 3 of the rail routes, including the Mersey, led away to vast industrial parks squatting on the outskirts of Leonida City, while the remaining 2 stretched out into the countryside, where forking again and again, they connected with the principal agricultural towns. Goods flowed in and out of the CST planetary station day and night, slowly increasing in quantity as the years progressed, circulating money, material, and machinery across fresh lands, advancing the human boundary month by month. A big freight train grumbled alongside, going only slightly faster than the Carlton. Dudley looked over at the sound, seeing long olive-green wagons rolling along steadily. The sulphur-yellow lettering on their sides faded from age and sunlight. There must have been 50 of them linked together, all pulled along by a giant 20-wheel engine. It was one of the GH7-class engines, he thought, though which particular mark he wasn't sure. Those brutes had been in use for nearly 80 years, a 35-meter body filled with superconductor batteries powering massive electric axle motors. Graalmond wouldn't see anything bigger until the planet reached full industrialization status, in maybe another 70 years or so. Already, such a monster trundling through the flourishing city seemed slightly incongruous. This district still contained a lot of the original prefab buildings, 2 or 3-story cubes of whitened aluminum with solar cell roofs. Redevelopment was hardly necessary on a world where the government gave land away to anyone who asked for it. Graalmond's total population barely reached 18 million. Nobody was crowded here. The prefabs, however, remained as useful housing and commercial centres for the newest and poorest arrivals. But many city blocks of the shabby metal boxes had been torn down and replaced by new stone or glass-fronted buildings as the local economy bootstrapped itself upward. More common was the encroachment of dry coral, a plant originally found on Macaria. New residents planted the genetically tailored kernels along the bases of their houses, carefully tending the long, flat strands of spongy, pumice-like stone that grew quickly up the walls, broadening out to form a sturdy organic shell around the entire structure, with simple pruning keeping the windows clear. The passenger terminus was only a small part of the 10 square kilometres that was the CST planetary station. Most of the area was given over to marshalling yards and engineering works. At one end was the gateway itself, sheltered from the weather beneath a broad arching roof made from crystal and white concrete. Dudley could barely remember it from his arrival 11 years ago. Not that it would have changed. The Carlton drew up at the departures rank at the front of the terminal, then trundled off home as soon as he stepped out with his luggage. He walked into the station to find himself immersed in a throng of people who seemed to be going in every direction but the one he wanted. Even though it was relatively new, the concourse had an old-fashioned look to it. Tall marble pillars held up a high glass roof. Franchise stalls lurked in the cathedral-style archways. The short stairways between levels were implausibly wide, as though they led to some hidden palace. Statues and sculptures occupied deep, high alcoves, every surface covered in bird droppings. Big translucent holographic projections hung in the air, crimson and emerald signs that backed up the train timetable information for anyone who didn't have an interface with the local network. Little birds zipped through them continuously, hooting in puzzlement at the trail of sparkles their membranous wings whipped up. "The Verona train is leaving from Platform 9, Dudley's e-butler told him. He set off down the concourse toward the platform. Verona was a regular destination, with a train leaving every 40 minutes. There were a lot of commuters from there, middle management types from the finance and investment companies who were involved with setting up and running Graalmund's civil infrastructure. The Verona train was made up of 8 double-decker carriages hooked up to a medium-sized PH-54 engine. Dudley shoved his cases into the baggage compartment on the 5th carriage and climbed on board, finding an empty seat by one of the upper deck windows. Then there was nothing to do but try to ignore his growing tension as the timer display in his virtual vision counted down toward departure time. There were 7 messages for him in his e-butler's hold file, half of which were from his students, containing both data and audio clusters. The last 5 months had been extraordinarily busy for the small university astronomy department, even though there had been no stellar observations made in all that time. Dudley had declared that the state of the telescope and its instruments was no longer acceptable, and that they'd been neglecting the practical side of their profession. Under his supervision, the tracking motors had been dismantled and serviced one by one, then the bearings, followed by the entire sensor suite. With the telescope out of commission, they also had the opportunity to upgrade and integrate the specialist control and image analysis programs. At first, the students had welcomed the chance to get their hands dirty and improve the available systems. But that initial enthusiasm had long since faded, as Dudley kept finding them new and essential tasks that delayed recommissioning. Dudley hated deceiving them, but it was a legitimate way of suspending the whole Dyson pair observation project. He told himself that if he could just secure the evidence, then the impact it would have on their department and its budget would more than justify the small subterfuge. It was only during the last couple of months, as he put up with all their complaints, that he'd begun to think of the effect a verified envelopment might have on his own career and fortunes. Failure to back up the observation would have ruined him. Success, on the other hand, opened up a whole new realm of prospects. He could well progress far beyond anything the Graalmund University could offer. It was a pleasant daydream to lose himself in. The train started moving, pulling away from the platform and out into the spring sunshine. All Dudley could see through his window was the industrial landscape of the station yard, where hundreds of tracks snaked across the ground, crossing and recrossing like some vast abstract maze. Single wagons and carriages were being moved about by small shunting engines that coughed out thick plumes of diesel exhaust. The only visible horizon seemed to be made from warehouses and loading bays, where a spidery gridwork of gantry cranes and container stackers wove through every section of the big open structures. Flatbed carriages and fat tankers were being readied or unloaded within the mechanical systems that almost engulfed them. Engineering crews and maintenance bots crawled along several tracks, performing repairs. Traffic began to increase on the tracks around them as they headed for the gateway, long cargo trains alternating with smaller passenger carriers. All of them snaked their way over junctions with sinuous motions, arrowing in toward the final stretch of track. On the other side of the carriage, Dudley could see a near continual stream of trains emerging from the gateway. There were only two tracks leading to the gateway, one inbound, one outbound. The Verona train finally slotted onto the outbound stretch, fitting in behind the passenger train for Edinburgh. A freighter bound for St. Lincoln slotted in behind them. A low warning tone chimed through the carriage. Dudley could just see the edge of the curving gateway roof ahead of them. The light dimmed fractionally as they passed underneath. Then there was just the wide, shimmering amber oval of the gateway dead ahead, so reminiscent of an old-fashioned tunnel entrance. The train slid straight into it. Dudley felt a slight tingle on his skin as the carriage passed through the pressure curtain that prevented the atmospheres of the two worlds from mixing. Even though it spanned 118 light-years, the wormhole itself had no internal length. The generator machinery that created it had a considerable bulk, however, most of which was tucked away in the massive concrete support buildings behind the roof. It was only the emission units that were contained in the great oval hoop of the gateway, measuring over 30 meters thick. Given the speed the train was traveling, even that flashed past in a second. Glorious copper twilight streamed in through the carriage windows. Dudley's ears popped as the new atmosphere flooded into the carriage through the rooftop vents. He looked out at the massive expanse that was CST's Verona station. There was no visible end to it, no glimpse of the megacity that he knew lay beyond. One edge of the station was a solid cliff of gateways, sheltering under their curving, single-span roofs, each oval framing a slightly different colored patch of haze, depending on the spectral class of the star whose world they reached. But for the rest of it, as far as the eye could see, trains and tracks were the sole landscape. Behemoth freighters rolled along, their engines dwarfing the GH-7s that had so impressed Dudley, nuclear-powered tractor units pulling 2 kilometer chains of wagons. Sleek white passenger expresses flashed past, pulling dozens of carriages with multi-world commuters, whose routes would take them through 20 or more planets as they rushed from gateway to gateway on a never-ending circuit. Simple little regional trains like the one Dudley was on shuffled between their larger, grander cousins. Verona Station had them all. As Earth was the junction world for all the planets in Phase 1 space of the Intersolar Commonwealth, so Verona was the major junction for this section of Phase 2 space, with gateways leading to 33 planets. It was one of the so-called Big 15. The industrial planets established out along the rim of Phase 1 space, 100 or so light-years from Sol. Company-founded, company-funded, and company-run. Verona Station boasted 7 passenger terminals. Dudley's train pulled into number 3. Again, the scale of the place hit home. This terminal alone was 5 times the size of Grauman's planetary station. Verona's thicker atmosphere and slightly heavier gravity contributed to his feeling of triviality as he wandered along the packed concourse in search of the Taniata service. He found that eventually on platform 18B, 3 single-deck carriages pulled by a diesel-powered Abel's RP2 engine. His luggage went on an overhead rack, and he sat on a double seat by himself. The carriage was less than a third full. There were only 3 trains a day to Taniata. When he arrived, he could see why there were so few scheduled services. Taniata was very definitely a frontier planet, the last to be established in this sector of Phase 2 space. It simply wasn't commercially practical to build wormholes that reached any farther. Verona would link no more human-congruous planets. That honor now fell to Saville, which was less than 10 light-years from Graumond. CST was already building its new exploratory base there, preparing to open wormholes to a new generation of star systems, Phase 3 space, the next wave of human expansion. The CST Taniata station was just a couple of hurriedly assembled boron steel platforms under a temporary plastic roof. A crane and a warehouse comprised the entire cargo section, backing onto a vast muddy yard, where stacked metal, containers, and tanks formed long rows on the badly mowed vegetation. Wagons and trucks grumbled along the aisles, loading up with supplies. The settlement itself was a simple sprawl of standardized mobile cabins for the construction crews who were laying down the first stage of the planet's civil infrastructure. Quite a few prefab buildings were being integrated, with men and big manipulator bots slotting together reinforced aluminum modules inside a matrix of carbon beams. The biggest machines were the road builders, tracked mini-factories with big harmonic blades at the front chewing up soil and clay. A chemical reactor processed the material into enzyme-bonded concrete that was squeezed out at the rear to form a flat, level surface. The thick clouds of steam and fume swirling out from around the units made it virtually impossible to see them fully. Dudley stepped out onto the platform and immediately reached for his sunglasses. The settlement was somewhere in the tropics, with a clammy humidity to go with the burning blue-tinged sunlight. To the west, he could just see the ocean past a series of gentle hills. He pulled his jacket off and fanned himself. His skin was already sweating. Someone at the other end of the platform called out Dudley's name and waved. Dudley hesitated in the act of raising his own hand. The man was just over 6 feet tall, with the kind of slim frame that marathon runners cherished. Physical age was difficult to place. His skin was heavily ock-tattooed. Patterns and pictures glowed with hazy color on every limb. Gold spiral galaxies formed a slow-moving constellation across his bald head. The perfectly clipped, graying, goatee beard was the only real clue to late middle age. He grinned and started to walk down the length of the platform, his kilt flapping around his knees. The tartan was a bold pattern in amethyst and black. "Professor Bowes, I presume." Dudley managed not to stroke his own ock tattoo.
Yes.
He put his hand out.
Lionwalker Air.
Even the way he pronounced it was wrong, like some kind of disapproving bachelor uncle. He hoped the heat was covering any blush to his cheeks.
"That'll be me. Most people just call me Walker."
Great. Okay. Walker, then.
"Pleased to meet you, Professor."
"Dudley."
"My man."
Lion Walker gave Dudley a hearty slap on the back. Dudley started to worry. He hadn't given any thought to the astronomer's name when the data search produced it. But then anyone who had enough money to buy a 4-foot reflecting telescope, then ship it out to a frontier world and live there with it, had to be somewhat eccentric.
"It's very kind of you to allow me a night's observation," Dudley said.
Lion Walker smiled briefly as they headed back down the platform.
"Well, now, it was very unusual to be asked such a thing. Got to be important to you, then, this one night."
"It could be, yes. I hope so.
I asked myself, why one night? What can you possibly see that only takes up such a short time? And a specific night as well."
"And?"
"Well, that's it, isn't it? I could not come up with a single thing. Not in terms of stellar events, and I know there are no comets due, either, at least none I've seen, and I'm the only one watching these skies.
Are you going to tell me?"
"My department has an ongoing observation of the Dyson pair. Some of our benefactors were interested in them. I just want to confirm something, that's all."
"Ah."
Lion Walker's smile grew wise. "I see. Unnatural events it is, then."
Dudley began to relax slightly. Eccentric he might be, but Lion Walker was also pretty shrewd. They reached the end of the platform, and the tall man suddenly twisted his wrist and pointed a finger, then slowly drew a semicircle in the air. The ock tattoos on his forearm and wrist flared in a complicated swirl of color. A Toyota pickup truck pulled up sharply in front of them.
"That's an interesting control system," Dudley commented.
"Ah, well, that's the one I favor. Sling your bags in the back, will you?"
They drove off along one of the newly extruded concrete roads, headed out of the busy settlement. Lion Walker twitched his fingers every few seconds, inducing another ripple of color in his ock tattoos, and the pickup steering would respond fluidly.
"Couldn't you just give the driver some verbal instructions?" Dudley asked.
"Now what would be the point in that? My way I have control over technology. Machinery does as I command. That's how it should be. Anything else is mechanthropomorphism. You don't treat a lump of moving metal as an equal and ask it pretty please to do what you'd like.
Who's in charge here, us or them?"
"I see." Dudley smiled, actually warming to the man.
"Is mechanthropomorphism a real word?"
Lion Walker shrugged.
It ought to be. The whole bloody Commonwealth practices it like some kind of religion. They quickly left the settlement behind, driving steadily along the road that ran parallel to the coast, just a couple of kilometres inland. Dudley kept catching glimpses of the beautifully clear ocean beyond the small sandy hillocks standing guard behind the shore. Farther inland, the ground rose to a range of distant hills. There wasn't a cloud in the sky, nor any breeze. The intense light gave the tufty grass and coastal reeds a dark hue, turning the leaves almost jade. Small scrub trees grew along the side of the road. At first glance, similar to terrestrial palms, except their leaves were more like cacti branches, complete with monstrous red thorns. 50 kilometers cleared of the settlement, the road curved inland. Lion Walker gave an elaborate wave with his hand, and the pickup obligingly turned off, heading down a narrow sand track. Dudley wound the window down, smelling the fresh sea air. It wasn't nearly as salty as most H-congruous worlds. "See the way they laid the road well inland?" Lion Walker called over the wind. "Plenty of prime real estate between it and the coast. 30 years' time, when the city's grown up, that'll sell for $10,000 an acre. The whole area will be covered in rich men's beach houses." "Is that bad?"
"Not for me," Lion Walker said with a laugh. "I won't be here."
It was another 15 kilometres to Lion Walker's house. He'd taken over a curving bay that was sheltered by dunes that extended for several kilometres inland. His house was a low bungalow of pearl-white dry coral perched on top of a large dune, only 100 metres from the shore, with a wide veranda of decking facing the ocean. The big dome of the observatory was a little farther back from the water, a standard concrete and metal design. A golden Labrador ran out to greet them, tail wagging happily. Lion Walker fussed with it as they walked to the house. Dudley could hear the sounds of a furious argument while they were still 20 meters away.
"Oh, Lord, they're still at it," Lion Walker muttered.
The thin wooden shutter door slammed open, and a young woman stormed out. She was startlingly beautiful, even to Dudley, who was used to a campus full of fresh-faced girls.
"He's a pig," she spat at Lion Walker as she hurried past.
"I am sure," Lion Walker said meekly. The woman probably didn't hear. She was already walking toward the dunes, face set with a determination that made it clear she wasn't going to stop until she reached the end of the world. The Labrador gave her a longing look before turning back to Lion Walker.
"There, there," he patted the dog's head. "She'll be back to give you your supper."
They'd almost reached the door when it opened again. This time it was a young man who came out. With his androgynous features, he was almost as beautiful as the girl. If it hadn't been for the fact he was shirtless, Dudley might even have questioned his gender.
"Just where does she think she's going?"
he whined.
"I don't know," Lion Walker said in a resigned tone. "She didn't tell me."
"Well, I'm not going after her." The youth set off for the beach, slouching his shoulders and kicking at the sand with his bare feet as he went. Lion Walker opened the door and gestured Dudley inside.
"Sorry about that."
"Who are they?" Dudley asked.
"They're my current life partners. I love them dearly, but I sometimes wonder if it's worth it, you know."
"You married?"
"Yes. Several times, actually."
"Eh? Well, you know what it's like then."
The interior of the house was laid out in a classic minimalist style, which suited the location perfectly. A big circular fireplace served as the focal point of the living room. Tall, curving windows revealed an uninterrupted view of the bay and the ocean. Air conditioning provided a relaxing chill.
"Sit yourself down," Lion Walker said. "I expect you could do with a drink.
I'll take you over to see the telescope in a minute. You can check it out then.
I'm confident you'll be satisfied."
"Thanks." Dudley lowered himself into one of the big sofas. He felt very drab and colourless in such surroundings. It wasn't just the richness of the house and its setting, but the vivacity of the people who lived here as well.
"This isn't what I was expecting,"
he admitted a few minutes later, when he drank some of Lion Walker's very agreeable 50-year-old scotch.
"You mean you thought I'd be somebody like you? No offence, my man."
"None taken. So what are you doing here?"
"Well, I was born with a reasonable trust fund.
Then I went and made even more money for myself in the commodities market. That was a couple of rejuvenations ago. I've just been loafing ever since. So why here? Why Tenyata? This is the edge. This is as far out from our starting point as we've got. Well, with the exception of far away. That's a wonderful thing, even though everyone regards it as commonplace. I can sit here at night and look where we're going. You look at the stars, Dudley. You know what marvels there are to be seen out here. And those cretins behind us, they never look. Where we are now, this was what our ancestors thought was heaven. Now I can look out from their heaven and see where our future lies. Do you not think that's a thing of glory?
Certainly is.
There are stars out here that you cannot see from Earth with the naked eye. They shine down out of the sky at night, and I want to know them.
Me too.
Dudley saluted him with the crystal tumbler that was 100 years older than the scotch it held, and gulped it down in one. The two youngsters returned after a couple of hours cooling off by themselves. Lion Walker introduced them as Scott and Chai, as they sheepishly greeted Dudley. As a penance, the two of them set about building a bonfire on the beach, using the local driftwood that had a curiously matted texture. They lit it as the sun sank down toward the ocean. Bright orange sparks blew out of the flame tips to swell high above the sand. Potatoes were pushed into the heart of the fire, while a makeshift barbecue grill was prepared for when the flames died down.
"Can we see the Dyson pair from here?"
Scott asked, as the stars began to appear in the darkening sky.
"No," Dudley said, "not with the naked eye. They're too far away. You can barely see Earth's star from here, and the Dyson pair are almost 1,000 light-years beyond that."
"So when were they enveloped?"
"That's a very good question. We've never been able to pin down the exact construction time of the shells. That's what my observation project is going to help solve."
Even now, Dudley wasn't going to admit what he'd observed. Astronomy, post-2050, had effectively ceased to be a pure science. CST had long since taken over all major deep space observation for purely commercial ends. In any case, when you could visit stars of every spectral type to observe them directly, there was little point in prioritizing astronomy. Few higher education institutions on Commonwealth worlds bothered building observatories. Even Oxford's telescope had been over a century old when it discovered the Dyson pair. An hour after sunset, Dudley and Lion Walker walked through the dunes to the observatory. Inside, it was little different to the one on Grammond, a big empty space with the fat tube of the telescope in the middle, resting on a complex cradle of metal beams and electromuscle bands. The sensor housings surrounding the focus looked a lot more sophisticated than anything the university could afford. A row of neat, modern display portals was lined up along the wall beside the door. Dudley glanced around at the professional equipment, feeling a degree of tension ebbing away. There was no practical reason the observation shouldn't occur. All he had to deal with was his own memory of the event. Could it really have happened like that? 5 months after the fact, the moment seemed elusive somehow, the memory of a dream. Lion Walker stood close to the base of the telescope and began what looked like a robot mime dance. Arms and legs jerked about in small, precise movements. In response, the doors on the dome started to peel open. Electromuscle bands on the telescope cradle flexed silently, and the fat cylinder began to turn, aligning itself on the horizon where the Dyson pair were due to rise. Lion Walker's body continued to twist and whirl. Then he was snapping his fingers to some unheard beat. The portals came alive one by one, relaying the sensor images. Dudley hurried over to them. The image quality was flawless. He gazed at the starfield, noting the minute variation from the patterns he was used to.
"What sort of linkage have we got?"
he asked his e-butler.
"The planetary cybersphere is negligible. However, there is a landline to the CST station. Available bandwidth is more than capable of meeting your stated requirements. I can open communication to the Unisphere whenever you want."
"Good. Begin a quarter of an hour before estimated enclosure time. I want full SI data vault storage and a Unisphere legal verification of the feed."
"Acknowledged."
Lion Walker had stopped his gyrations, allowing the telescope to rest. He raised an eyebrow. You're really serious about this, aren't you?
Yeah.
A data vault store and legal verification were expensive. Along with his ticket, the cost had taken quite a chunk of their carefully saved holiday money. Something else Dudley hadn't told his wife. But it had to be done. With the telescope sensor feed authenticated, the observation would be beyond dispute. Dudley sat in a cheap plastic chair beside the telescope, his chin resting on his hands, watching the holographic light within the portals. He watched the dark sky obsessively as the Dyson pair rose above the horizon. Lion Walker made a few small adjustments, and Dyson Alpha was centered in every portal. For 80 minutes it remained steady. A simple point of ordinary light, each spectrum band revealing an unwavering intensity. Lion Walker made a few attempts to talk to Dudley about what to expect. Each time he was waved silent. Dudley's E-Butler established a full wideband link to the Unisphere and confirmed that the SI data vault was recording. It was almost an anticlimax when, right on time, Dyson Alpha vanished.
Yes!
Dudley yelled. He jumped to his feet, sending the chair tumbling backward.
Yes! 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 I was right!
He turned to Lion Walker, his smile absurdly wide.
Did you see that?
Eh? Lion Walker grunted with false calm. I saw that.
Yes.
Dudley froze.
Did we get it?
He asked his E-Butler urgently.
Unisphere confirms the recording. The event is logged in the SI data vault.
Dudley's smile returned. Do you realize what that was? Lion Walker asked.
I realize. It was impossible, man. That's what. Completely bloody impossible. Nobody can switch off a star like that.
Nobody.
I know.
Wonderful, isn't it?